You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. You just heard about vegan food, which fits in with how a lot of us try to change our behavior at the start of the year. Exercising more, eating healthier, kind of getting ourselves together. And there is no shortage of experts and businesses who want to sell you stuff to help you reach those goals. But often we ignore some of the most basic ways to get healthier. James Hamblin is the senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's also a doctor, and the author of If Our Bodies Could Talk, a guide to operating and maintaining the human body. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I actually want to start with one of these little graphics in your book, which I'm holding right here. It's like a food pyramid, but it's factors that affect health. At the top, small impact, clinical interventions. In the medium, preventative interventions. And then the biggest impact, the like sort of foundation of the pyramid, is socioeconomic factors. And obviously this is an economics show, so why is this big area down here?
Yeah, I think that idea, that pyramid, was based on something that was put out by the CDC, and it's an overlooked concept in our country where we think about healthcare as hospitals and pills and surgeries. But in fact, if you look at the research, most of what determines longevity and health is your day-to-day choices, which are heavily determined by your environment and what sort of opportunities you have, kind of food you eat, people you hang out with, where you live, et cetera.
So why'd you write this book then instead of just like a long treatise on economic inequality?
That's in the works. This book is framed around the structure of a health QA book, which is actually a common thing. There was a book in 2005 called Why Do Men Have Nipples? Kind of answering body trivia. And so what I did was took that form and expanded it to show how social and economic circumstances actually factor into the answers to those questions.
Do you think that businesses, and particularly the sort of like embedded in our consciousness kind of American businesses, do they create conflicts of interest or bad incentives for us in terms of how we take care of our bodies? You know, I'm thinking Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And that's an easy example. But then let's say you have, you know, General Mills is trying to sell you different kinds of cereals. Like, how as a consumer do you sort through that stuff and figure out what's the best for you or your kids?
Right. I think if there is a simple rule, it's to not believe what food labels are telling you about health claims. At the end of the day, soda companies are still trying to sell you something that is more than water, and packaged food companies are trying to sell you something that is more than fresh fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and legumes and whole grains. And we really don't need anything more than that. So anything else is superfluous and or detrimental.
Wow. So you also have a section in here about something that I feel like comes up a lot. And I know from reading your column that you are particularly fascinated by claims around things like toxins and allergens. I'm curious why you think there's such an increased public consciousness of that and whether anything like clean eating holds scientific weight.
The idea of a toxin is itself interesting in that it's a relative term. Water can be toxic when you are drowning in it. When you have too much of almost anything, almost any vitamin, almost any food, you will suffer health consequences. So it's easy for marketers to say that something is a toxin and then to sell you a sort of antidote to something that wasn't actually hurting you. As a consumer, you can say, why not err on the side of safety? Why not just take no chances, eliminate this thing, even if there's only a 1% chance of it being dangerous? So the threshold of them convincing you that something could be dangerous is much lower than the threshold of them convincing you that something is actually helping you. If they're selling you something positive, saying, this is going to do this, this, and this, it's harder to sell that than it is to sell, just play it safe and try this, and it might help.
A lot of the things that you lay out in this book feel to me like they, in fact, come back to the pyramid at the beginning of the book, because we as Americans are so primed for a clinical solution to whatever is wrong with us rather than a behavioral or socioeconomic solution for our problems or whatever it is that's bothering us. How do we make progress then to invert that and not expect a magic pill?
Right. It kind of comes back to fee-for-service medicine and people wanting a system that is structured to reimburse people for doing things, for writing prescriptions, for doing procedures.
And we should say that fee-for-service medicine, doctors get paid by the thing they do as opposed to, say, a flat salary.
Right. And they don't get paid for, say, putting a park into a neighborhood, starting a farmer's market. The financial incentives to actually keep people healthy are often at odds with the financial incentives to have people be sick and in need of the services that keep them from dying.
How would you fix that?
This is where I need my big treatise on economics. But if you look at the healthiest societies in the world, there is less income inequality and there is more equality throughout societies. So when you have people who are struggling, when people who can't meet their basic needs or can't get a good night's sleep, can't get access to good food, don't know how to interpret this onslaught of health information that's coming at them because they didn't have much education, then you see lifespans start to radically separate in terms of the wealthy people and the poor people and how long they live. And even in within the United States, there are places where within the same city, within Los Angeles, there is a 10-year life expectancy difference from one area of town to the next.
There are some interesting stories in here about the successes and failures of public policy in terms of how they change people's health. You talk about the war on poverty and a lot of things that didn't work. But then some of the outgrowths of, say, the Watts riots and a series of small health clinics that made a huge difference. What are the models that we have seen where you can say, oh, you know what, that's actually a really good low-cost way to get medical care to people?
I talk in the book about this federally qualified health center, which is a program of clinics around the country which treat low-income populations. And there's this one that I profile called St. John's, which is in South L.A., which has specifically arisen to meet the needs of the transgender community. And what they try to do is improve the community around them. And this is sort of a trend that's spilling over into larger healthcare systems because as soon as you align an incentive for that clinic to not have people coming back every day, but to try to keep people happy and healthy, then you actually see meaningful improvements in the community. So St. John's is involved in helping people find housing, helping people find transportation to and from the clinic, helping people fill their prescriptions, taking on the full picture of health.
So, Jim, about a year ago, year and a half ago, I went to Brazil on a reporting trip. And as you know, I became terrified at the idea that I was getting bitten by a botfly and was going to have a botfly larva grow inside of me. And so I sent you – how many pictures do you think I sent you?
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, I recall a string of pictures and texts. They seemed to say that you were rather concerned about it. And I think you became kind of upset at me that I don't have expertise in that area and was unwilling to speak to that subject.
Yes, I was.
Subject, or unable to.
And I like to think that this book grew out of my botfly fear, that you decided to write an owner's guide to a human body precisely so that people like me wouldn't bother you with all of our questions.
That's basically it. So now when I have friends and family text me with any sort of questions, I can refer them to my book or just say, please buy my book.
Jim Hamblin, author of If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.